Welcome to another episode of Shypedia on WGN Plus. This is your girl, Marsha Marsha, and there's so much happening in the Windy City, which means that we have a jam-packed show. Starting off, we have Vanessa Abrams of Agency Abrams, a boutique PR agency here in the city. She calls in to tell us about her event coming up, the state of the music business in Chicago, a panel discussion that anyone who wants to be involved with the music industry should attend. Also, funny man Ari Spears stopped by to talk about his upcoming shows at the Chicago Improv in Schaumburg. And since this is the month of May, which means that this is Foster Care Awareness Month, Steve Pemberton and Mark Vadik dropped by to talk about Steve's new film, which reveals Steve's life's journey early on growing up in the foster care system. Hang tight with this episode, you guys, because you're going to learn a lot, you're going to laugh a lot, and you're probably going to shed a few tears. This is Shypedia. On the line, I have my girl, Vanessa Abrams. She's only the best PR person here in Chicago. Only the best. But I have her on the line right now because she has a really big event coming up. Vanessa, how are you?
I am good. Thank you for having me. You're making me blush.
Oh, come on. Vanessa, what do you have going on here in Chicago that everyone needs to attend?
I'm really, really excited to announce that I am hosting a panel discussion next Monday, May 21st, called The State of the Music Business in Chicago. And we have some phenomenal music influencers lined up. It's going to be at the Make office in the Loop at 1 North State Street from 6 to 8:30 p.m. And it's free to attend. So we're looking forward to hosting musicians, producers, managers, music publicists, anyone that's involved in music in any sort of way in the Chicagoland area will want to be in this room.
Who are some of the confirmed panelists that you have?
That is a great question, and I'm actually feeling really honored and blessed. So we have Tiana Lewis coming. She is the head of pop programming at Pandora, and she's actually flying in from California to be a part of this discussion. So that's exciting. We also have Frain Lewis, who is over music at the Department of Cultural Affairs and Events for the City of Chicago, but he's also a composer and music producer as well. We have Maurice Joshua, who is a Grammy Award-winning producer based here in Chicago, from Chicago as well, still lives here. Done some amazing things with Beyonce and Destiny's Child, to name a few. We also have Kenneth Neal Crump. He has a background in both public relations and music booking, and he also is an up-and-coming artist. He's lived in California and Chicago and decided to come back to Chicago because he felt there was more opportunity here. So looking forward to getting his perspective. We also have Kevin Ross of Two Guard Media. He is joining us. He has a background working entertainment management for labels such as Capitol Records and Motown. And finally, we have Patrick Welby joining us. He is the director of strategic partnerships at Project, and he's also the co-founder of These Days News, which is a music blog, as well as the co-founder of Oxcore DJs, which is basically a music-based event where he showcases amateur DJs.
Wow. Please explain why, especially if you're an artist or you're pursuing a career as being an artist, why do they need to be there for this?
There's this perception right now that says that if you want to excel in music, that you need to be in LA or maybe New York and even perhaps Atlanta. And at one point in time, Chicago was actually considered on that list as well. Not to the same extent, though, as LA, New York, and Atlanta, but it was kind of in the game. We had a point of our life where every major label had an office here. You had Universal Records had a base here. Sony BMG had a base here. Everyone had a base here. Then when the industry began to crumble around 06, 07, 05, 06, 07, when everything started to change, those offices began to close. So meaning often often questioned, is Chicago really a place that I can grow as a musician? And then you look at people like Kanye West, who is based here, and he left before he really became popular. He left Chicago and moved to New York, and oftentimes the narrative is Chicago produces great talent, but they don't grow here. They have to leave in order for them to be successful. And so now the question is that still true? And is it not still true? So we're actually going to allow the audience to figure that out for themselves, because there actually is opportunity here depending on what perspective you look at it. A lot of people don't know that Chicago is home of one of the largest independent music PR firms. It's also the home of one of the largest booking agencies. So we actually have some really great resources and talent that a lot of people are kind of overlooking. So we're going to explore that. But you're also going to have some people that may have some differing opinion as to whether or not. So we're going to actually have different perspectives, which is why the panel is so diverse, because we want a diverse perspective and a diversity of thought on this topic. And so we're going to allow the audience to see or hear what resources are available that they may not know of, or maybe the resources that are here isn't enough for them and they do have to move. So it's going to give people the information they need to really make that choice.
Okay, that's good. Because I've heard people say that, you know, we need to leave Chicago in order for our career to blow up. Mm-hmm. And this is a perfect panel. So for anyone out there that's looking to pursue your dreams in the industry, then this is definitely a panel that you want to attend. Can you please tell them again where this is going to be and the times? And I do see some food on here.
I'm actually glad that you spoke of the food. So I'll go back and tell you. So it's going to be Monday, May 21st at the Make offices in the Loop, which is located at 1 North State Street. It is going to take place from 6 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. and it is free for all to attend. You can find us on Eventbrite. You can just search State of the Music Business in Chicago and it should come right up. But if you want the exact URL, it's stateofchicagomusicindustry.eventbrite.com. So again, it's stateofchicagomusicindustry.eventbrite.com. We are going to feed everybody. I'm not going to say we're going to give full course meals or anything of that nature.
Just a little appetizer, just a little.
Yeah, but we are going to have some nice food there. And actually, our food sponsor, her name is Monica J., and she is going to have some nice, delectable bites for those who are both vegan and those who are not vegan. So we're going to have options for everyone, because I know I have vegan friends who always complain that when they go to events, mm-hmm. they don't have options to eat. So we will have options for both vegan and non-vegan foodies. And Monica J., she is wonderful. She's the founder and CEO of this company called Tasteful Manners. She got into food because she wanted to make an impact on healthy lifestyles for those in her community. So she definitely focuses on healthy eating. But if you want her to get not healthy, she can do that too.
I think I'll try both.
Right. She's amazing. Amazing. I'm so glad that she has agreed to be a part of this. And actually, she's going to give a few words during the discussion as well. So, and she's going to talk about the intersection of food and music.
Okay. And Miss Vanessa Abrams is such a good, reliable source, because you've been running your own PR agency, the Abrams Agency, for how long?
It's Agency Abrams, and actually this month makes 3 years, which I am surprised you asked that question, because now as I say it out loud, I can't believe it.
Wow. Yeah, time flies.
Yeah.
So I know you've been awarded a few times within the 3 years that you've been doing it.
It's been some time coming. Uh-huh. Yes, I've been hustling. So what I do want to clarify is that when people hear like only 3 years, and yeah, I'm still kind of a newbie as far as entrepreneurship goes, but I've actually been working in public relations for about 13 years. Mm. So, and what a lot of people don't know is before I got into public relations, my background started in music, and which is how this panel came together. So when I was at least 10 years old, I used to like write rhymes, and I would always like wrap my presentations at school. I always thought I was going to be an MC. thought I was going to be a producer. And as I began to explore the music industry, I got more fascinated with the business of music. I was drawn to that. So I always thought I was going to be like the next Quincy Jones or something of that nature, or some fancy A&R executive. I always thought that I was going to be just some powerhouse in the music business. And I was working in that direction. I've done the internships. I did internships with Hidden Beach. I did internships with Murder, Inc. Records, if anybody remembers what that is. Then I worked with Atlantic Records. Then I moved over. When I came back home to Chicago, I worked with a company called Shrewd Marketing and Promotions, and we did a lot of grassroots and experiential marketing initiatives for a lot of different labels, such as Def Jam Records, Interscope, Virgin, Bad Boy. So that was really a lot of great experience for me, and I was climbing that ladder. But as I was continuing to climb that ladder, that's when everything changed. And everyone began to lose their job. So anyone that could help me get to that next step couldn't help me because they were either A, not there anymore, or B, just holding on for dear life for their job.
Mm-hmm.
So because I'm very personable, a lot of people kept saying, Vanessa, you should really look into going into public relations. And at first I was hesitant about it because I had this notion about what public relations was and should be, and I didn't think I fit that mold. And I actually still don't, but I've been in business for 13 years, so I guess they saw something I didn't.
Yeah.
But I transitioned from music into public relations, and I started doing internships all over again at agencies such as Weber Shandwick and Hill & Knowlton. Hill & Knowlton then hired me, and I stayed there for 6 years until I was hired by Johnson Publishing Company, where I was head of media and public relations for not only Johnson Publishing as an overall company, but for Ebony Magazine, Jet Magazine, and Fashion Fair Cosmetics. So that really accelerated my career, but also allowed me the opportunity to intersect my entertainment background with my PR background.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really excited. It was kind of like a dream come true. Transitioned to Nielsen. I was there for a little bit before I became independent.
Mm. Yeah, well, you've been in the game for a while. So so I'm really happy that you're putting this together, though, at Vanessa, because, you know, this is needed. This is very necessary. You have a lot of aspiring artists in Chicago, and they just feel like they don't have any outlet. Everyone wants to push their record to the radio stations. I just want to be heard. I want to be heard. Or they don't know what next step to do. So this is very helpful. And please give them your social media as well, because, you know, you may pick up a few people on your own. They may need you, Vanessa.
Sure, and I'm just gonna touch on what you just said. Like you said, so many people want to get their music heard on the radio and whatnot. But mm-hmm. what a lot of people don't know is that there's a lot of artists that can be successful without ever being heard on the radio. You just have to know how to utilize your resources.
Uh-huh.
For example, one of my panelists, Kenneth Neil Crump, he oftentimes uses Chance the Rapper as an example, and he compares Chance the Rapper to Kendrick and says that if you look at the numbers, he basically made just as much as Kendrick without the same amount of album sales, without the same amount of tickets sold to concerts. But because he's on an independent label and able to utilize his independent resources, he's able to make more. So sometimes people want, you know, sometimes these artists, they're looking to get these 360 deals from these record labels, which may not necessarily be the best bet. And in my opinion, I don't think it is. And it's funny because I remember when I was knee-deep into the industry, I saw that the way to go was independent. And I'm really surprised now that a lot of artists aren't really taking advantage of being independent, especially now that we have resources that allow you to go straight to the consumer. You have social media, you have YouTube, you have SoundCloud. So
why do you think they're not choosing that, though? Do you think it's just from lack of knowledge, or what?
Yeah.
What is it?
I definitely think it's lack of knowledge. I think it's a narrative that's been fed to us that you need this label backing. And oftentimes it's money, you know, because pretty much the biggest thing that you would get from a record label is the upfront money to do what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
The bad part about it is you got to pay that money back.
Yeah.
And even if you do it, that doesn't mean your project is going to get to see the light of day.
Mm-hmm.
So... And oftentimes you also lose creative control, and you may often lose rights to your own music if you don't know how to negotiate your contract the right way, because you're so excited about being on this record label.
Right. We've seen enough of those stories of those contracts coming back and kicking them in their butts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, so sometimes, like I said, it's a lack of knowledge, a lack of, you know, just knowing. And sometimes it's a lack of funds. So, you know, you kind of have to look at your business like any other entrepreneur. When you're an artist, you have to know, I'm an entrepreneur. I have to save up for my business. I have to invest in myself. So mm-hmm. as an entrepreneur that wants to start a store, this person has to save up money to get a storefront and to, you know, get employees and mm-hmm. to do blah, blah, blah. So you have to look at your music career the same way.
Mm-hmm.
I have to save up to go into the studio. I have to save up to do blah, blah, blah. Like, you can do all of this stuff yourself, or you can hire someone to do it, but it still costs money.
It's going to cost money.
Right. And so people get intimidated by that and just rather have someone else pay
yeah.
for it.
Yeah.
And not knowing that could hurt you, because yeah. if you can just do little by little. Like, you don't have to be an up and coming artist by, you know, releasing an album right away. You can just release a song here and there, and then grow from there. So we're going to go deep into that. But I definitely want to touch on that since you brought it up, and
yeah.
we can get more clarification from the panelists who will be there.
Right.
But if anybody wants to follow me, they can follow me at Agency Abron. That's AGENCYA, B as in boy, RON. So that's Agency Abron. That's my professional Instagram and Twitter. But you can also follow me on my personal, which is Vanessa Abron, which is VanessaA, B as in boy, RON as in Nancy.
All right. Everybody got to get their questions out. That's just one of the few things that can hit the panel. And I know there's a lot of questions out there, but you must be present in order to get your voice heard and get some answers and the help that you need. So thank you so much, Vanessa, for reaching out and letting us know what's going on. And we'll be sure to spread the word.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, you know, it's funny. Those of y'all that know me know I'm a big Jay-Z fan. I hope I get to be that famous before my career is over, because this motherfucker surpassed being a rapper. He's a rock star. Like, you know you huge when you can sell out Africa. Like, he could fill a soccer stadium in Africa and they hold between 80,000 or 100,000 people. He could sell that out by himself. Like, don't get me wrong, DMX and Ice Cube is cool, but they're not selling out Africa. And Jay-Z is a master showman. He's a game changer, which means he ain't gonna just perform to perform. He gonna do some shit to change the situation, because he know they starving out there. Like, he'll probably do some fly shit, like halfway during the show, have helicopters fly over the arena and drop bags of rice into the crowd. Like, how gangster would that be if he was like, it's your boy Young Hov, and you know how nice. I know you're hungry, rice.
They coming in here.
Mm.
They coming in here to see Mr. Aris Spears. Mm.
Well, they better make sure they come in this weekend, because Mr. Aries Spears is going to be in Schaumburg.
Yes, yes, Schaumburg. Yes.
We want to officially welcome Mr.
Thank
Aries
you.
Spears
Thank
to Shypedia.
I'm going to be a half hour away from civilization.
Yep.
Over in Schaumburg.
Man, Schaumburg, why did they go to Schaumburg?
You know, I wish they had a club here in the city, but they don't.
Yeah.
So Schaumburg is where it be at.
Okay.
Yeah, one show tonight, two Friday, two Saturday, one Sunday. For all the ticket information, go to improvschaumburg.com.
The Improv.
Yeah, the Improv.
We in there.
Yes.
Yeah, we are in there.
Yeah, we in
Please
there.
Be. Please be.
And all these voices that you hear is my guest host, Smash. I'm in a room
Smacks.
Full of comedians.
She always teaches.
Oh, you do comedy?
Yeah, I do comedy.
All right.
Yeah, I've been doing my thing for about a year now.
Oh, that's what's up.
You know, getting booked and things, you know what I'm
that's
saying?
That's what's up.
You feel me?
I hate to say smack, because I just feel like you might be
with
a little violent.
It's an S.
It's smash.
Smacks.
With smacks.
Smacks.
Like sugar smacks?
Like
so plural smacks.
Yeah, plural.
Like, you get hit with two hands.
Two hands. There you go.
There it is.
Everybody, I'm in the studio with two comedians. Please save me. So I grew up watching Mad TV.
How old are you?
I am ...
I'm waiting for an answer.
Answer.
Okay, I'll be straight up. I am 37 years old.
Okay, yes. All right. So, you ain't completely a spring chicken.
Right. I'm not completely a spring chicken.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that.
You in your prime.
Yes, I am.
Yeah, you in your prime.
Yeah. You know?
Love.
I was in high school watching you on Mad TV.
I'll take that.
You were one of my favorite characters.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
How many seasons did you last?
Did I last? Like I was on a... Death Watch.
Right.
Yeah, I know, right? Because he made it. I
was there for 8 years.
He was one of the finalists.
That's a long time.
Yeah, I was 8 years.
A long time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's a nice childhood right there. Eight years. That's
but nice. 8 years.
Man, so right now, what are you working on, Aries?
Besides being booked up for the entire year touring, y'all can check out my new podcast called Spears and Steinberg, available through iTunes with my guy who features with me on the road, Andy Steinberg, very funny Mexican Jew. And if you don't have or you don't mess with Apple or iTunes, you can go check out Spearsberg.com, and it's got the details on there how you could get it through your Galaxy or your Samsung or your Android or whatever kind of device you got. And then I think they're still airing the episode, well, not the episodes, but airing the AVN Porno Awards, which I hosted on Showtime. Check your local listings for that.
You said Porno Awards?
The Porno Awards, the AVN Porno Awards. Very popular. They've been doing it since the late 80s.
You've been out here shooting a little bit?
You mean being in porn?
Yeah.
No, I'm comedically host.
Okay.
I host the award show.
I'm about to say, it's okay to throw a little, you know, a little...
Nah. I don't put my gallivanting on camera.
Because I'm on Backpage. You familiar?
I know what it is.
Right. I got my profile. Slango Django. I'm ready.
Okay. It's getting awkward. But yeah, there's that. And then, you know, I just did a little independent movie, which I think... will be coming out soon, called Kings with Halle Berry and Daniel Craig.
Oh, that's what's up.
So there it is in a nutshell.
Okay.
Be on the lookout for that.
So,
yeah.
You know, you're doing a film with Halle Berry. I mean.
Yes.
Yeah, well, did. I didn't have any scenes with her, unfortunately.
So this is not going to be, what was that,
Monster's Ball.
Not in the slightest bit.
Right.
But, you know, it's still Halle and it's still Mr. Craig.
Yes.
So
yes.
It's good company.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed. You get those credentials. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Okay. So, since times has changed, and being a comedian, how do you relate now to this generation? Are you trying to relate now to this generation?
I don't think for me it's a generational thing. I just think it's a human being thing. You know, yes, there is things that in terms of age and experience separate us, but there's also things in terms of experience that keep, you know, that bind us together. So just from a human standpoint, I'm able to convey on stage what we all go through and what we all experience and all our frustrations with everything that's going on in the world, and, you know, blacks being slaughtered by police, and, you know, a continuous justice system that continues to fail us racially, whatever's going on in pop culture, a little bit of politics with this crazy fool we got in the White House, and, you know, the stuff that we live through on an everyday basis with, you know, family, love, man, woman stuff, kid stuff, raising kids and, you know, family stuff like that. So as long as those things continue to exist, to relate is not a hard thing to do.
Okay, so how do you bring it on stage, though?
A lot of vodka and marijuana.
They need to be up.
You put those two things together, anything comes out.
So another question, kind of piggybacking off of what you just said as far as what's going on in the industry right now. How do you stay basically relevant, being you were like kind of back in, I don't want to say back in time, but you are a bit older than I am in this generation. So, but you've been kind of relevant a little bit. Well, I wouldn't say a little bit, a lot. So how do you stay relevant being a comedian, because you have to basically have good material, new material, old material? How do you basically stay relevant?
You know, you just answered your own question.
I wanted to.
New material, good material.
Right.
That's how you stay relevant.
Right.
You know, you got to stay on your toes, and you got to, you know, you know, make sure you keep your finger on the pulse of what's going on. And, you know, people that know your work and that respect you, they follow you and they're loyal. It's like being a pastor in a church.
True.
You know, you can almost do no wrong when you got your congregation behind you.
Basically.
And they support you because, you know, every Sunday you put on a good sermon.
Yeah.
So as long as I continue to do what I do and do it at the level that I do it, and the respect factor is there, you know, my flock still, you know, follows the shepherd.
Yes,
sir.
Locking behind.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, but now things have changed because social media is now in the picture.
It's getting
heavy. So, you know, you get to see and hear what people are thinking.
Well, most of it is garbage.
Most of it is in it.
You know, people, I think at the end of the day, substance always weeds itself out.
Uh-huh.
You know, as long as you have substance and longevity, people see through the bull.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? And social media really hasn't done much but give a lot more people their 15 minutes of fame.
Oh, my gosh.
You know what I mean? So, you know, just because you hot for that 15 minutes, that's one thing. And if you can capitalize off it in some way, that's even better. But at the end of the day, when the sizzle starts to fade and the heat cools down, what next?
True. That's just like fizzling through, like the being stupid is the new thing now.
Not for me. I'm 43. I'm too old to fall for that one.
Of course. But people are like really getting on for like being stupid, doing the dumb things, like doing extravagant things that don't even make sense. And it's like it's the new end right now.
Right. Well, you know, like the saying goes, there's a sucker born every minute. So if you can feed them garbage and they're willing to eat garbage, then serve them garbage.
Serve them garbage.
But the people that don't eat garbage and like, you know, Ruth Chris and Five Star Cuisine, they're the ones that's going to be around with you.
That's true.
I've been following your Instagram page.
Uh-huh.
I guess I can say that you don't feed them garbage.
I try not to.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, every now and then, you know, somebody got to eat a hot dog. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I like to, you know, I love the Ruth Chris. I like the sizzle. I like the smell of the butter. I like the plate being hot.
Has there ever been a moment where you had to just step outside of yourself and put somebody in line?
Oh, constantly.
Okay.
Constantly. You know, maybe to a fault, I take pleasure in having you try to match wits with me.
True. Mm.
So if you want to play tongue tennis with me, we can play tongue tennis, but your serve better be proper.
Mm. Come on now, Venus.
Hey, I'm a tennis Serena. Player too. I like that talk.
So with that, how have you been? Because obviously with that, you got your freestyle game got to really be on point,
right?
So how do you work out with your freestyle versus your material?
Well, that comes with time and experience. You know, once upon a time ago, I was a deer in headlights at the thoughts of having to go beyond my playbook. Mm-hmm. But all the great ones have that ability. So,
true.
You know, you put your toe in the water, see how I feel.
Mm-hmm.
And the more and more comfortable you get, eventually you immerse yourself in the whole pool.
True.
So, you know, like I said, once upon a time ago, I used to be scared of it. Mm-hmm. But now I relish it.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Because I'm not saying that I'm the best at it. But I've certainly gotten better.
But you're very
from
witty.
Where I've started. So it's like anything else. You put the time in, you put your work in the gym, and you train yourself so that everything slows down, you know, like the Matrix. You know, when that punch comes,
mm-hmm.
you see it before it even gets to you. And you know how to, you know, respond accordingly.
So another question, Ben, doing comedy, have you ever been booed?
Yeah, I had a rough time in the worst way because it happened when I was at home in New York at the Garden.
But you say home is New York, but you are a Chicago
home,
native.
Home is where you lay your hat. So if we talk in technical, yes, I'm from Chicago.
You're born
but
in Chicago.
But I left Chicago right after I was born.
Okay.
And I spent all my, you know, childhood and young adult, somewhat adult life in New York, you know, so home is where you lay your hat. You know, everybody associates Michael Jordan from being from where?
Chicago. But his home is North Carolina.
Oh, well, even that. You just said it. Chicago is where he played.
Right.
But his home is...
North Carolina.
North Carolina.
We just like to adopt people.
No. But here's what I'm... My point.
Okay.
He's not even from North Carolina.
Right.
Michael Jordan is from Brooklyn.
Brooklyn, yeah.
New York.
Exactly.
As is Tupac.
Mm-hmm.
Tupac was born in Brooklyn. But everybody will say... West Coast.
Right.
Everybody say North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And Michael Jordan himself goes, I'm just a country boy from North Carolina.
Right.
So home is where you lay a hat, man. Yeah. I love Chicago, but I just don't know nothing about it.
Mm.
You know what I mean? If somebody would have dropped me here, you know, right when I was able to comprehend geography a little bit, I wouldn't have been able to tell you what was this way to that way. You know, you put me in the heart of New York, you know, at 8, 9 years old, I knew where this was and that was.
But,
and,
you know what I mean? As the saying goes, if you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere.
That's true.
Yeah, that's what they say.
We feel like if you can make it in Chicago, you can definitely make it anywhere.
Well, you can at least live a longer life. They'll be handing out bullets like gum.
Yeah, for real. All different sizes.
Yeah.
Now, you were saying how you dealt with being booed.
I was just saying that, you know, it happened for me in New York at the Garden, you know, in front of 5,000 people.
Mm.
But, you know, like anything else, man, you gotta dust yourself off and get back on the horse.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It doesn't happen often. You know what I mean? I mean, it happened in my earlier years.
Mm.
But again, the more time you put in the gym, you know, you pick up certain tricks and things. I always say comedians are kind of like magicians.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what might seem spontaneous to people in the crowd because they've never seen it before,
mm-hmm.
or what might seem amazing to them, ooh, rap it out the hat. As comics, you know, from doing this, from the experience of being in different cities and, you know, experiencing, you know, different climates and temperatures in terms of audience, variety, race, slow people, smart people.
Right.
You pick up on things and you know how to put it all together so that by the time you done doing your thing, you David Blaine in the crowd.
True.
You know what I mean?
Mm. Mm, so you could eyeball a person down pretty much. Do you jive still?
Jive.
That's a. I got old school. I like that.
I like that. I like that. Do I jive? Do I jive. You play the dozens,
right?
Yeah, I jive. You know, it's funny because what happens is a lot of times people in the, and this is what separates amateurs from professionals. People in the audience, they may have that one good thing to say to you.
Mm-hmm.
So when you know they hit you with it, boom, 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 they not ready for the block. Punch, counterpunch, counterpunch.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like, so they say that one thing and they done shot their best shot. The real good comics will anticipate what it is they could possibly say to you.
That's true.
And then you got to go, well, what's the comeback for they comeback?
Mm-hmm.
So if you put together a 5-punch combination for they one punch, game over.
They're going to stop. They're going to
game over. I remember I did a comedy club in Milwaukee one time, and it was the first and only time I've ever seen this. The comedy club was literally attached to a strip club. So you could literally walk out the comedy club, walk 2 feet, and you in a strip club.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember I tweeted, and this is when I was a lot heavier, too. I had tweeted, damn, you know, as a dude, you thinking, what man don't like looking at
right.
You know what I mean? You know, so that's a hell of a choice. Jokes at which one would you pick?
Mm-hmm.
And before I sent the tweet, I went, here's what somebody's going to say. And sure enough, they said it. They went, well, with you Aries, I get both.
Ooh.
So, again, my point is, if you anticipate what's coming, you know how to then throw out the proper thing to deflate that.
Mm.
And most people that aren't professional comics, they got their one good shot.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, it's a wrap.
Yeah.
So, for your one, I'm going to give you 6.
Mm.
Mm.
That's tough.
Yeah.
That's some good advice.
That's some very good advice.
I know, like, Nene from Housewives, she was put out of her... off the tour with Escape because she couldn't take an audience member saying something. So she went kind of overboard. Do you feel like she went overboard for that?
Well, I don't even know. I haven't even seen what that footage is.
Okay.
But I can tell you just from the fact that Nene Leakes is not a comedian at heart.
Okay.
I don't need to see the crime scene to know that it was a murder.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? She's not built for this.
Mm.
So, that is expected to happen. That's inevitable. But a lot of these reality, and this, as we said earlier, a lot of these reality stars, social media, internet stars that get their 15 minutes make the mistake of thinking that they're talented.
Mm.
just because you have been able to manage to get your way on a show based off of reality TV that we know is scripted in the first place,
exactly,
based off of your zany personality, again, that's not substance. You to pick it, you to pick it a week. As soon as your expiration date comes up, now what? So a lot of these, and you know, ego, man. You put a camera on somebody where they can see themselves. They know other people are seeing them, and all they need to do is get a little bit of adulation. Walk down the street, you so and so. Let me get a picture. Let me get an autograph. It don't take much to fill up the balloon. Just a little bit of air, and now you start believing your own hype. So there's a difference between truly talented and, you know, you for the moment. So when you buy into your for the moment hype, the letdown gonna be a
What would be your advice to people who are aspiring to be comedians?
Take it serious. This is not a game. You're playing with a loaded gun.
How do you brand yourself now? What would you say would be the best way of branding yourself nowadays?
Well, first of all, before you brand yourself, again, make sure you got the goods. Mm-hmm. Put in the time. Put in the work. You know, build a name based off, you know, true talent and not a gimmick. Mm-hmm. And then the rest will take care of itself. You know what I mean? You know, you brand yourself all day long. If people ain't buying your product,
exactly,
then that brand don't mean nothing. You know, make something that the people want to buy. Put out a good product. Then you can do whatever you want. It's almost like, you know, Denzel in American Gangster when he had that scene where he had to go interact with Cuba Gooding. He was like, you know, what you want me to call it? Red Magic? I don't care what you call it. Put a chokehold on him. Just don't let me see you doing this again.
Right.
Pepsi, it's a brand name. Like, it's a brand name. You know, so he put out Blue Magic was a product that the people could believe in. So put the product out there first. Then you can call it whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm. So how did Aries Spears come about? Like, what inspired you to actually feel like, okay, I'm a comedian. This is what I'm going to do. This is my career. What started that?
Yeah, like, were you a class clown?
No, I hate that term, class clown.
You said that earlier today.
Class clowns do anything for laughs. I was specific. I was a class comedian. I was professional. You know, I had always had a love for comedy. And, you know, Eddie Murphy, back in the 80s, me and my father used to make it an appointment to watch him every Saturday on SNL. Mm-hmm. Then he took me to go see 48 Hours and Trading Places, and I was really sprung. And then prior to that, you know, my pops was always a movie buff comedy guy. So I had watched movies with Mantan Moreland and Steppin' Fletcher and Moms Mabley and Bill Cosby, Sidney Poitier, Uptown Saturday Night, Let's Do It Again. You know, prior, I'd seen all the prior stuff and the Red Fox records and Rudy Ray Moore and Jimmy Lynch. So, I was immersed in laughter. And then when I kind of felt like it was something that came to me naturally to do, I just made the marriage come together and go, you know, this is maybe my calling, you know.
So do you think you were always funny, even before the comedy?
Yeah, I think I was always funny. I don't know that I was always right,
right,
in my decisions in trying to be funny. And that's something that I'm still trying to figure out. But as far as, you know, naturally funny,
right?
Yeah, I think I'm kind of possess that ability.
Yeah, let me do a little something.
What was the first? Do you remember like that first time you really made a large group of people just laugh? You knew this was like, oh yeah, I'm that guy.
Well, yeah, I mean, again, I was in school and in any function.
So you was a class clown.
No, baby, she was class comedian.
Class comedian.
Okay.
Class comedian.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, I don't wear a bright red rose and slip on banana peels.
Right.
I was very specific with my comedy. You know, I would just any time that I could feel a moment where I could put the attention on me.
And you just like to make people laugh.
Yeah, right. You know, it's a rush. It really is a rush. To know that you have the ability to make people's stomachs hurt, clench their jaws, rub their temples, wipe their tear ducts, and, you know, make women take their panties off.
Yep.
That's always a good skill.
Is that something that comes with the territory?
Absolutely.
Correct the mundo.
Anything. Listen, we all know women. Y'all know it. Laughter is a natural aphrodisiac. You know, and some people
found somebody that can make me laugh.
Right. Well, no, a lot of people make you laugh. Who makes you take your drawers off
while you're laughing?
Is a master. Yeah, I don't want to just make you chuckle. If I can make you chuckle to the point where you lose yourself and take your drawers off, then I have reached my last dragon glow status.
Yeah.
All right. So give me your best pickup line.
I'll tell you what. I'm gonna have you set me up, right? Because to just say it like that out organically doesn't feel right. Because it feels
feel
like
right.
a pickup line.
No, you want me to lead you in?
Here's what I want you to say to me. When you saw me, what was the first thing about me that made me catch your eye, or that you, you know, made me catch your eye? Am I saying that right?
Catch your attention,
yeah.
Okay.
So let's set the mood.
Act. Come on, Marsha.
Me and you are on a date. We're at your favorite restaurant.
Chili's.
Is nice. And we just sitting at the table, and now we have a conversation, and this is the question.
You know, I'm just curious. What was it about me that attracted you? What was attractive about me to you when you first saw me, Aries? I really want to know.
The fact that you have the ability to light up a room that's already lit.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, this is sweet. So where
are
we going after this?
No, I don't want you to glaze over that because I want to know. So what did you think of it? What did you think about the line?
I wanted to keep going, you know.
Oh, you wanted to keep playing?
Because that really wasn't going to get no panties, though.
Huh?
Like, that wasn't it.
That's not the point. Okay. It's not to try to get your panties. To
all
get
right.
your panties involves
you're
a lot
get
more.
You trying to you
exactly.
work your way through the
up
top.
He wanted you to
screw
really,
the mind. Screw the mind, and the body
he
follows.
You to really think
if,
about.
If I thought that you was going to give me some sex off of one line. Then what does that say about you?
About your, right.
Yeah.
You're going to make me work for it. So, you know, let me give you the appetizer before I put the steak in your mouth.
There you go.
Ready?
Literally.
Yeah.
Steaker.
Yeah, yeah. You're showing your age now a little bit.
How?
You're showing your age a little bit.
Am
yeah,
I?
Yeah, you are.
How?
No.
I need to go practice.
I tell you what. Here's what you do. Go to my podcast, right? Spears and Steinberg.
Okay.
Episode 27, and listen to the breakdown of that. Like, now this is not me being braggadocious. This is just me going off of 29 years of experience doing stand up on the road and knowing women.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an animal when it comes to this shit. I know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so many dudes are in a rush. They don't understand the importance of going slow. Mm. The slower I go, the faster you'll go.
I swear. I learned that too. Listen to this man. 43.
I'm trying to tell you.
He's 43.
Listen, podcast number 27. You will call me and say, thank you, Aries. I'm going
on there to listen to it.
When I say tongue tennis, I'm trying to tell you, I'm a wordsmith when it comes to words. That's why when you went, that line ain't going to get to me. I asked you, that's why I specifically want to ask you, so what did you think about the line? Because I read it on your face. Like, you looked at it like, yeah. Man, that was all right.
You didn't even catch the question. You were so caught on the line, you didn't even catch the question. He said, what did you think about that line? So what did you think about the line, Marsha?
No, she said it.
Well, you know, it's a little old school.
Okay.
You know, nowadays, I don't think that, you know, guys just don't go slow. 30-year-olds, they don't go slow.
Back up. What did I just say?
He just said that, and okay. I'm agreeing to it.
Okay.
I am agreeing to
all
it.
Right.
So, no, you know, but you like to take women out on dates a lot. You do the work, right?
Yeah, put in the work. You got to put in the work. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, well, men nowadays is a little late.
No, don't say just some men.
Yes, yeah, most men.
Most men.
Yeah. Because
nowadays.
I find that most men, you know, to me it's like most dudes either don't know how to do it or too embarrassed to do
right.
what's necessary to unlock a woman's head. And that's why I'm saying if you unlock the head, the getting the is easy.
So tell us, Aries, what do you think the first step is into unlocking a woman's head? What do you think you should do to unlock a woman's head?
Listen.
Listen.
That's it.
Listen. That's the first step.
Pay attention.
Mm-hmm. People on the live, the first step.
Pay attention.
Pay attention and listen.
Mm-hmm.
Give me five steps. That's what was that? One step?
You're going to have to pay now. You're going to have to pay for the rest.
we trying to get some substance here, okay? For these men that's really trying to do it out here the right way.
I don't know how y'all's thing work, but if y'all could, you know, when you listen to the podcast, that episode in particular.
I'm going to listen to it.
If there's a way you could play a good portion of that, because I don't want it to be taken out of context, because context is important. Mm-hmm. But if you can play from the moment I start talking about it to the time I'm finished, and I would love for you to watch her play it, because what I would love for you to do is look at her eyes.
Okay.
Look at her body language.
We're going to look.
You're going to see some shifts in body language.
Mm-hmm. Is it going to be like the shoulders or like the pelvic area?
I put it to you like this. When you do what you're supposed to do to a woman prior to sex, I mean foreplay, at one point while she's laying on her back, you will see her rise up like her spirit is leaving her body. Mm. If she don't go, you ain't doing it.
There's
areas you can touch on the ankle bone, the back of the knees. Then you don't go for the obvious. You got the obvious. You got the neck. You got the back of the ear. You got the nipples. But there's areas inside the inner thigh that you could do with some hot lotion and some cold ice.
Mm. Tear a soul up, huh? You could tell.
Well, that's just a sample of what we're going to expect for the next few days.
I don't get that explicit in my show.
You don't? Okay.
Because that's a turnoff for dudes who got girlfriends.
Right.
You know, no man wants to sit next to his woman at a show and have her shifted in her seat because her seat is juicy.
Babe, it's like a porno.
Yeah.
Babe, do you want to go to the Aerie Spirit show again?
Yeah.
So you really like that, huh? I thought you said you was basic.
Okay, so we've all fell in love with your impersonation.
Uh-huh.
You know, the Bill Cosby.
Yeah.
That's one of my faves.
Is it really?
Yes, it is.
What is it you like about Delman? I want to know specifically what I've got to do to get the weasel. I'm going to be going to jail for a very long time.
Yeah, Bill, what happened?
And
tell
before
me.
I go, young man, I'm talking to the lady. Don't have me treat you like the Theo. I'm talking to the young 37-year-old. I'm about to hit it with the 73-year-old Cosby.
So, Bill, did you do it for real, Bill?
I don't even know what you're talking about. All the ladies that said no really said yes, because when you sleep and you can't say no, then yes is to be interpreted.
But we Bill, love you, Bill.
Bill, you almost 80, Bill.
Yes, I said 73. Was you listening?
I said almost 80, Bill.
Okay, there it is.
So if you go to jail, you might die in jail, Bill.
Well, you know, I've already died in spirit. And like anything else, if they give me a pill, maybe I can come back. But I guarantee you, Cosby will make some friends in the system, and I'm going to get me some booty myself, you see. Oh, man, y'all got me working up in here.
Okay.
We finna get all this.
That's okay. We want to definitely just remind everybody, though, about the next few nights.
Yes, tonight, one show, two shows, Friday, Saturday. Two shows Saturday, one on Sunday. Go to the website, improvschomburg.com. Instagram at Aerie Spears Official. Twitter, Aerie Spears. Facebook, Aerie Spears. All things free comedy. Subscribe to Pandora. It's free. And again, the Spears and Steinberg podcast. Available through iTunes, Apple. Go to Spearsberg, SPEARS.BERG.com for the Android, Galaxy, and all that other good stuff.
All right.
There it is.
Well, we'll be sure to be...
And don't think that when we was walking down the hall to come in here, I didn't notice them cakes you got there swinging as I was walking behind.
Listen, cakey.
I pay attention to everything,
do
honey.
Do you really, honey?
Yes, I do.
All right, sugar.
Yes, I do.
All right, sugar.
He coming down the hallway trying to look all, you know, laid back.
Mm.
But that's airy though. You know, you got to understand. That's
she's gorgeous though.
Yeah,
from scalp to cuticle, baby, you're good.
There you go.
I can tell his old school flavor though.
Mm.
Yep, that's what I'm used to. The old school flavor.
Mm. I ain't used to it. You know
that's
it.
That's why my baby daddy is so old.
Is that right? How old is he?
12 years older than me.
Is that right? Mm. Atta girl.
Atta girl.
Like, Aries, you so crazy.
Thank you, baby.
All right, well, thank you so much.
Thank
for
you for having
us
me. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.
And Smacks, go ahead and tell everybody where to find you as well on Instagram and social media.
Y'all can find me on Instagram. That's Smacks Mr. ESPN. Facebook, Keith Smacks Dean. Twitter, Smacks Mr. ESPN. All of the above. Backpage, Slango Django. All of the above. No, we making it happen out here with Aries Spears.
And cut them thumbnail. Don't hurt somebody.
I be needing these. I use these for like boogers. you know, like scratch my beard. You
I
know,
got you, baby.
Things.
I got you, baby.
Sometimes I might want to put my thumb in a little. You know,
there it is.
You know, it helps. It intrigues.
I feel you. I done went down an alley that I wasn't supposed to go down. Appreciate y'all, man.
With my next guest, I don't want anyone to get confused thinking it's President Barack Obama. This guy's demeanor and his voice has great similarities. Mr. Steve Pemberton is a best-selling author, a philanthropist, an acclaimed speaker, a senior level executive, and now he can add a filmmaker as one of his credentials. As we all know now is that May is Foster Care Awareness Month. And Steve is also familiar with the foster care system, which is why he is bringing his life story to the big screen. A Chance in the World is the name of his film, where he shares his triumphant life's journey from being in an abusive home and being a victim of a failed system. You were taken away from your mom at an early age, and then you were sent to a foster home. Were you adopted?
I was never adopted. I should have been. I was with multiple families early on, and then one family was granted temporary custody of me, and that temporary custody was for over 13 years. There's nothing temporary about 13 years. That's a long period of time. So that's a technical, you know, term.
Okay.
Temporary custody.
So tell us about this family.
The Robinson family were masters of deceit, deception. My travels these many, many years later have brought me in contact with a lot of people, different walks of life. And some of those walks of life are people for whom shrewdness is their business, is how they show up in the world, it's their value system. Don't fully understand it. They don't have a lot of honor and integrity, and so you keep them at a distance. But I've never met or encountered anybody like that family.
Now, were you the only child they had?
No. In fact, over the years, they had taken in 39 foster children, specifically. But so they were masters at painting themselves as this wonderful, caring, kind, adopted family. I remember walking through that home and seeing awards on the wall for taking in foster children. And meanwhile, I know that something else is unfolding here. So they have these terrible and insidious rules. I came to call them the Robinson rules. I couldn't be seen reading in their presence. I was to tell no one what was unfolding in the home. It just seemed to me, especially at a young age, they were put here for the express purpose of trying to break my spirit.
Tear you down. Break your spirit.
They didn't win.
They didn't win.
No. They only fueled my efforts, actually.
As a young child and coming into this system without any guidance from the beginning, how was it that you were able to fight this?
You know, I think it's a combination of things. I'd probably tell you that when the good Lord was handing out defiance, I probably stood in line at least twice, if not more. But I came to understand the story of my father's life in particular. I saw where that defiance came from. He was very defiant. But his life took a different path than mine did. What helped me a great deal were these interactions. They were oftentimes fleeting, but they were so impactful and so important to me. And I can still remember all the details of them. A mailman, Mr. Mead, who lived in that neighborhood, would see me reading, which is what I love to do. And he would wink and nod and say, "Keep reading." Mm. Didn't say much more than that. A kind neighbor who brought me books because she saw me reading the same book over and over again. A construction crew that, you know, one summer adopted me and gave me a little tube belt and a hard hat and let me be a part of their crew. So though I couldn't tell anybody what was happening there, I still had these interactions. They gave me a North Star. They let me know that there was still goodness in the land, that there were still good people.
Still
despite, yeah, absolutely. They were the personification of it. But it was an active hope. You know, not this passive, waiting, leave your fate to others kind of hope. Mm-hmm. Wasn't that hope.
What about schooling?
I was a titan in the classroom. That was my domain.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
No, I loved to read. Mm-hmm. And so because I
so
read
you,
as much as I did.
You pretty much would lose yourself in books.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, one of the central points of both the book that I wrote and then the adaptation of that book was the power of literacy. Because it really did give me an armor. It gave me a North Star. It gave me a vision of a different life than the one that I was living in. So I saw, because of what I read, intact families where there was love and caring and support. It deepened my curiosity about the world. And it also gave me this sense that I was going to, especially as I got older, that I was going to actually be able to defeat these set of circumstances. So it came to me, whether it was Watership Down by Richard Adams, who's writing about this group of rabbits who are small, defenseless, they seem to be overrun. And he says of them that for them, it's safer to fight than to run. So that's what I did. Or Lord of the Rings, and Bowen Tolkien says, you know, a new day will come. As long as if he had written it just for me, or you know, Tennyson's Ulysses, when he says, "Though much is taken, much still abides." So you know, you read those things, and especially when you're young, you feel like they're written just for you.
Yes.
So it gave me, you know, the sense of defiance was affirmed not through anything that anyone in this world said to me,
because there weren't any religion in the household, correct?
No, absolutely not. They
okay.
were, and I thought of them then, and I think of them now as godless people.
Are they still around?
They are not of this earth any longer.
Okay.
No.
Wow. So when you turned 17, what happened?
When I turned 17, well, there's something that unfolded before then. Okay. When I was 16, when I finally managed to escape this home. It does nearly cost me my life. It was very, it was just a very, very difficult moment, because what I'm daring to do is go to college, and they're trying to stop me, and I just refuse, because I knew that was going to be my future, so I couldn't let them take. They'd already taken my childhood. They couldn't have my future too. When I escape the home, though, I go to my social worker. It's 2 days after Christmas. And I'm watching him for the better part of a day, call family, trying to get somebody to take me in. And I can see how desperate he is. And I can also see that he has no answers. He asks me if I know anyone. And my first reaction was, I thought that was your job. Because he's literally asking me to help me help you is really what he was asking me. And initially I thought, no, I don't know anyone. But then I remembered a guidance counselor who I overheard say to another counselor that he didn't have any children, but if he did, he'd love for them to be a lot like me. So that's who he called. He was supposed to be on vacation because it was school break, but he wasn't. He was actually there in his office, as it turns out, correcting papers. I was supposed to stay with him for a week. The week becomes 2 weeks while the department was still trying to find a more permanent placement for me, and then it wound up being my last year of high school.
Wow. Yeah. Oh my gosh. When you talk about some of the stories that happened within this foster care, we know that you were abused mentally. Was there much physical abuse, or?
There certainly was. I mean, it was just how they handled any kind of situation that required discipline. They were extraordinarily violent people, volatile. And so their reaction was, in nearly any situation, was to strike. But that wasn't so much of the issue as it was just their use of violence to try and control me.
So why was it never reported?
It was never formally reported, although people, certainly neighbors, teachers, you know, they had their antenna up. They knew something, that there was this disconnect between what they kept saying in terms of who they were or saying about me, and you know, so it didn't match up. But they were well prepared. That foster family was extraordinarily well prepared for any kind or caring soul that came around who said, "Steve looks underweight. There's these bruises that he has." The closest I ever came to freedom was something that was powerfully depicted in the film when I've been hospitalized, and that's probably the one opportunity that everybody had to see.
Did you ever have that thought of just leaving a house and running away?
I ran away 4 times.
Actually,
wow. And they kept bringing me back.
So they would catch you, and they would send you right back to the same home without questioning. Like, why were you running away?
Yeah, exactly right. And lest your listening audience think that this is from a different time and different generation and things like that don't happen anymore. Just last month, a family from California, the Hart family, eerily similar set of circumstances. Children in foster care, multiple complaints, knocking on neighbors' doors for food at 2 o'clock in the morning, and in each instance, the children are brought back to the home. Authorities are alerted. So all the signs and signals are there. But there's this one overriding, and clearly these foster parents were masterful at painting this picture, that they were normal. Well, they were far from normal. In fact, one of the neighbors, when they were asked the same question that you just asked, how come no one did anything, they said, well, they looked normal. Well, what does that look like? I'm not sure what that looks like. The tragedy of this is that those 4 children, and along with those foster parents, perished when the foster parents drove their SUV off a cliff and killed the entire family.
Oh, gosh.
So again, this is not, these things are still unfolding. And all the signs and signals were there. They certainly were there for me. And I could see people wrestling with it. I could see them trying to figure out what to do. Because their instincts were telling them something very different than the stories that they were being told.
It's amazing how we can be so deceived. Looks are deceiving. However, the goal is to keep our children safe. Mm. And I feel as though sometimes society lets them down, and it seems like they don't try hard enough for the kids. And I as well, I hear a lot of stories of children mm-hmm. being in households where the evidence was there. The home was just nasty, and the kids weren't fed, and it just was a bad situation, and no one did anything, and it's just too late in a lot of cases.
In many cases, as I described them, they were real life monsters masquerading as human beings. And so their ability to deceive and to paint a picture of normalcy. I heard a story a couple weeks ago, a very difficult situation, but when the foster parent knew that the Department of Social Services was coming, they tidied everything up.
Wow.
They made sure everything looked perfect.
It's like a nightmare.
It is. And so it winds up making the child look like they're the ones who...
disobedient and just bad.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And it's... So, you know, I remember having those moments. They would send me to see a psychologist. I just refused. I would sit in the psychologist's office. I would play games with a psychologist. Because I thought, you need to be examining this family. Why am I here? Go examine them.
Gosh, you're screaming out, you're crying, and no one's listening.
Yeah.
But as I sit here and look at you as being an articulate guy, you're well put together. I'm just curious. I can't wait to see this film because I'm curious to see how you were as a little boy. Just to
well, yeah, that I think the young boy playing me, Terrell Ransom Jr., who's just an absolutely outstanding actor. You get to see somebody who's extraordinary at their craft. And he does such a great job of, on the one hand, representing the voice that I had to have at the time, which was shy and retiring, but at the same time, this very quiet will and sense of fight that most times I'm trying to mask. Most times I'm trying to mask it now, actually, because my instinct is to fight. That's my instinct. I don't know any other way. But I think the overarching point was that I had inherited, you look at the long span of the history of my families, I had inherited a tragedy that I didn't ask for. Yes. And I didn't create.
That's right.
But I was responsible for it. Now, that may not be fair, but it was the truth. Like, there was no one, our truth of it was that no one was going to come save me until I decided that I was going to save myself. And so you couldn't tell me that that wasn't possible for me. It's this combination of a warrior spirit that a lot of children have, actually. A lot of children have. But that warrior spirit needs to be met by a servant's heart at some point. You just have to have these people, I think, who come along at the right time to affirm that spirit, to affirm this belief you have in a different set of circumstances. And they can do that in the smallest of ways. For me, it was books. It was a smile. It was people used my name when they talked to me. People made eye contact when they looked at me and didn't look away in pity or empathy. I remembered all those things, even if sometimes no words were exchanged.
Wow. Does it affect you in any way right now? A lot of times when we endure things as children, we carry over that same weight.
There are some things that you lose, that all of us lose, that you never get back. The losses that I experienced early on were as wide as a 4-lane highway. I always thought my objective was to get that down to one single narrow country road. It's still there. It's just not nearly as wide as it once was. I'm fueled more now by a sense of legacy for my family. I just decided that I was going to be the last one that this had happened to.
Yeah.
It was it. It was going to end with me. And so that always fueled anything that I did. Getting to college, graduating from college, starting a family of my own. I'm still fueled by that. But I'm much more fueled now by the example I think that it sets.
What school did you attend?
Boston College.
Boston College. Mm-hmm. And what did you take up?
Political science. And then did my graduate work in sociology.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you have your family.
I do. I do.
How many kids?
Three.
Wow.
Tanya and I have been married for nearly 22 years. We have three children who are 17, 16, and 13.
Okay.
So two kings and a queen. Quinn and Vaughn are strapping young boys, both taller than me now. They actually get... they get height confused with an ability to fill a father's shoes. Those aren't the same thing. They're going to have to work at that.
It's a teenage thing.
It is a teenage thing. And then our daughter, Kennedy, finds these conversations about height rather humorous. She says, boys, don't you know that little girls are always tallest in their daddy's hearts, which is about right.
That's right. That is exactly right. So do you share your stories much with your children? How do they, what would they say about dad right now?
No, I think I'm just dad to them. You know, I'm boring. I think that's true for any
parent.
No,
but you're actually the cool dad. You have a book, you have a film, in which we could talk more about now, because I'm trying to visualize all of this in my mind, but I'm really anticipating to see this film. And we also have in a studio with us today, Mr. Mark Vadek. Welcome to Shypedia, Mark.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, okay, so Mark is the director.
Correct.
Of the film, A Chance in a World, which is based off of the book by Mr. Steve Pemberton. And tell me, how did you two come together? I know originally Steve went to Hollywood to pitch this idea. Mm-hmm. They took him through the bottled water tour. And after that, he made the decision to go independent. How did this come about?
We met through one of Steve's neighbors, mm-hmm. Who actually had read the book and liked it. He knew a producer I worked with, and Tom, who produced the movie, called me and he goes, you have to read this book. I was like, okay. And he sent me the book, and I started reading it, and I literally read right through it, which is kind of unusual, okay. You know. And it was a really moving story. And I called him back. I'm like, okay. He's like, well, we're thinking of turning this into a movie. And So we discussed some script ideas, and that turned into adapting it, and that turned into directing it.
Wow. And how long was this process?
And how long have we been hanging out? What, 3 years?
Yeah, about 3 years.
3 years.
Yeah.
And so I know you stated earlier that the process was just, oh my gosh, it was extremely difficult. Well, maybe not so much for Mark, because Mark, you've done this before. You've worked on editing for many projects.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so this was not as hard for you, but this is your first project, and I'm sure it won't be your last, because
I don't know about that, Martha. I'm sure everyone is going to be as good as Mark's been for any future projects. You know, but in all honesty, in all seriousness, you know, those meetings in Hollywood were sobering.
Okay.
I could see them struggling with what to do with me. I just didn't fit into any of the archetypes that often come out of that industry.
Mm-hmm.
And in their discomfort, they would say things that, though they weren't trying to, I found them offensive. They would ask me if I wrote the book. They would tell me how articulate and polished I was.
And so, obviously, they didn't know that you earned a master's in psychology.
Well, they didn't. They didn't know. I mean, Boston College, one of the top 20 schools in the land. They just don't hand those degrees out. But there was a bigger miss, I thought, and it was that they just failed to see that the very deficits you inherit actually become your fuel. So for me, it was not. It was not surprising, actually, that I would have turned out this way, because I meet a lot of people who have turned out that way. But trying to get, though they're well-meaning and well-intentioned, trying to get them to see that and stick to the truth of the arc of the story, which was important, which Mark inherently understood. The one thing I was particularly adamant about was that this was more of a partnership. Between me and John Sykes in particular, who's played by Tom Sizemore. John Sykes, who was a teacher who took me in, he didn't save me. If he were here, he'd tell you he won't accept that. In fact, he'd say, if anything, I'm the one who saved him, because he was going through a difficult period in his own life. A longstanding relationship had not worked out, and I came along at the right time. So, in other words, you know, we needed each other.
Right.
That's a very different story than the ones
that's
that traditionally presented.
Is.
It is, right?
Yeah.
It's reciprocal determinism. I determine it, and it also determines me. And that's especially true when you're dealing with issues of challenge and difficulty. And sitting down with Mark and having him get that, like, immediately was quite a relief, because at the time that he came along, I had put the project away. I was tired of those meetings, to be perfectly honest. I was tired of, though, I still remember one person saying, well, I don't know how this turns out. And I said, well, I'm right in front of you. What do you mean you don't know how it turns out? The reason, lastly, on this, that I was so adamant that what comes from this is you get the sense of a child's power to bend the arc of their own life was critically important. And that wasn't an exercise in vanity, per se. But when you meet so many young people, including, I was literally just texting someone before I came in here, young girl who found me on social media. She says, well, how do I get scholarships? I have no family. I have no sense of where to go. And so, of course, I'm responding to that, as I can. But I see her sense of fight, right? She's trying to fight. She's trying to get her own chance in the world. And so I have that opportunity to be what others were for me. It's very different than what is, the knight syndrome. Somebody comes galloping in on a great white horse and saves you. Well, that's not life either. You've got to own this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. We're in control, and we sometimes don't realize how much control we can have.
Right.
You are a passionate champion for the youth. What do you do now with certain people, like you were just speaking about? What do you do now for some of the youth that may be experiencing maybe similar issues or just going through something?
Well, a lot of it we're actually doing through the film. So the film is showing for one night only,
That's going to be May 30th.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. How many screens are we up to?
I think we're around 700, so it's pretty much all around the country.
Okay.
And if you go to, here's my shameless plug.
If you
go to fathomevents.com and you could look up A Chance in the World, which is on their homepage, and just type in your zip code, and it will literally give you three or four theaters around you that are closest, and you can get your tickets.
And part of what we're doing that evening is it's a call to action beyond raising awareness. And so we're working with foster care agencies all across America to bring both young adults and their benefactors to the theater so they can see, you know, some, not literally their life story, but some example of it. We're working actively on a book drive because literacy was such an important part. So there's all these elements, particularly in these dissonant and cynical times. Now, in all honesty, I think America is struggling with our identity and actually our very soul. What kind of country do we want to be? I think what the film does a good job of showing is what happens when you have the resilience of a young person and kind, caring adults who do small things that literally bend the arc of your life. I mean, there's a certain broader application to a lot of the challenges that we have, and there's something powerful about the people who impacted my life. They were teachers, they were nurses, they were construction workers, they were mailmen, they were neighbors who at the time had no idea the effect and the impact that they were actually having. And so you put all those things together, and I think what we're calling this a celebration of hope, because in many ways it reflects exactly that. You know, how do you take this situation that virtually every quote-unquote expert and informed person said there is no possible way that anything good can come of this? Well, a lot did come of it, but what came of it were things that any of us can do. I mean, any of us can impact this. We may not be in a position to open up our home to foster children, but you could become a CASA, which is a court-appointed special advocate. You can bring a box of books. You can take a foster child's picture. You can answer their question about how do I find scholarships. I mean, there's just things that we can do.
Or just being the eyes.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah. You know, when you see something that's wrong, and you know that this is a foster care situation, and you see something that's wrong, try to, you know, be that voice for someone.
Absolutely.
At least.
Yeah. And one of the other things about the movie is in addition to just having the screening, we're having a panel discussion afterwards.
Okay.
And that'll be satellite fed live from New York to all the theaters around the country. Steve will be on it, and we'll have some experts on adoption and foster care. DMC from Run DMC is going to join us because he also is an advocate for foster care. And it'll be a conversation about how the people who have watched the movie can help and get involved in very specific ways. And part of what we felt very strongly about was on the movie website, we'll be having a resource page. So, and that's going to stay up throughout. So if people want to go there, they'll be able to find local organizations that they can start getting active in helping these kids.
Okay. I'm curious to know, how deep does this film get? Do you reflect back onto that house? You know, do you have the family reenacted? Or, I mean, like, how far back do you go? Or
I'll let you answer that.
Mark.
I'll let you answer
yeah,
that.
We
it's a great question.
Yeah, we show the family. We've PG'd it up a bit just for the sake of expanding our audience, you know.
Okay.
But it's a troubling portrayal of the family. So yeah, we show what we can, and then again we kind of the purpose of the film though really wasn't to focus on the tragedy; it's to focus on Steve's triumph over that tragedy.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, but you can't show the triumph unless you show what he's overcoming.
That's right.
And so we try to balance that out.
Yeah, quite a balance. You know, both in the book and in the film though, the family got an enormous pass.
Yes.
They were much worse, actually, in real life.
So it's best for our audience to go out and possibly read this book first before seeing the film. that would be a great idea, a chance in the world. Yeah, pick indeed. The book up. Because he's revised it a few times since 2012, right?
I've had to because of all the stories that have come to me. That has been one of the most inspiring parts of this.
All right. We want to hear more about this film. Let's tell everyone how we can go about viewing this. Once again, we go to Fathom.
Fathomevents.com. Okay.
And this is going to be May 30th, correct?
Yes, it is.
And so it's going to be a live simulcast streaming. And then afterwards, there's going to be a panel with everyone talking about discussing the film, QA. Mm-hmm. And any other information that we need to throw out there. We need social media as well.
A Chance in the World movie.com is the website. So you can go to that and find some of our social media.
Okay.
We have a Facebook page by the...
We do. You can find me at I Steve Pemberton, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, as well, where you see a lot of these conversations, by the way, that are unfolding. So it's a little bit more than just the marketing element of them. Mm-hmm. You see the ways in which people are, you know, taking this on in their local communities, whether it is the local Y's or Upward Bound programs, of which I was apart, faith-based communities. Again, there's a certain universality here. We have some wonderful corporate sponsors that are assisting our efforts. I am the Chief People Officer for Global Force, which brings humanity to the workplace through positive social recognition. So they're a sponsor. RSM is also a sponsor. Hyatt, who's working with us on creating corporate externships for these young people who are aging out. The National Y, the wonderful women of Delta Sigma Theta are also supporting this through their Delta Red Carpet. So it's really becoming a movement, actually, which has Mark and I both extraordinarily excited because it so fits with my nature, actually, of defying conventional wisdom, and Mark's too, by the way. That's why we hang out as much as we do. But we wanted it to be a call to action, whether it's bringing a book to the theater, volunteering just a day in the life of, and also supporting these agencies who are doing some really extraordinary things. You Can here in Chicago, Home for Little Wanderers in Boston, New Yorkers for Children in New York, Foster Angels in Texas, I Foster in Southern California. These individuals are salt of the earth. They do not get paid a lot of money, and they see some of the most harrowing and disturbing things that happen to children, yet they still get up every day and they lean in as best they can. So they deserve their time on stage too, which I think we did a fairly good job of in Nick Turturro, who plays a social worker, and how important
Nick Turturro
was
in NYPD, correct?
Correct, yes.
Yeah.
Wow. So how did you pull this cast together?
Mark,
this is Mark's genius.
Great story. People were really touched when they read the script. And the script is obviously based on the book, and it's a compelling story. So we got good feedback from actors, and they came out and they did just amazing jobs. I mean, Kelly Owens, who is a local actress, who's a very nice lady, by the way.
She is.
So she plays the evil foster mother, but she's a sweetheart. So if you see her, don't be mean to her.
So it's really difficult for the audience to separate the two sometimes,
very
I tell
true.
You.
Yeah, that's going to really be true for Kelly, but she did a great job.
Yeah, she is lovely. Lawrence Hilton Jacobs plays the stepfather. He did a great job, too. Okay. So I mean, yeah, we had a very talented cast.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking forward to it. So this is the true story of trials and triumph. And one part of this story that I really would like to know is, have you located your siblings and have you located your mom?
Yes, I located both sides of my biological families. So I met all my siblings. They walked in and into the studio right now, you'd have no idea that we're related because we don't look anything alike. We have the same mother, but we physically don't look the same. My father's family, I've met all of them too. I have very good relationships with the overwhelming majority of my father was one of 13.
Mm-hmm.
And You know, what I came to learn from meeting those families, though, is that, you know, tragedy is also an inheritance, too. You know, they both of them came from very, very difficult family lives that they, too, didn't sign up for.
This is life, and everyone has a story to tell, and we're definitely looking forward to your story on the big screen, May 30th. Mark Vadik, the director, thank you so much. Thank you so kindly for even putting your heart and your help into this film and help bring in his story to the big screen.
Thank you. And thank you.
Thank you,
Marsh. Because we need this.
And thank you, Marsh. Thanks for having us.
Yes, we all need this. Yeah. And gentlemen, welcome to Chicago, and we'll be on standby waiting for a chance in this world. Before you see this film, please go pick up the book and read it. You have time. A Chance in This World by Steve Pemberton. Thank you so kindly for being on Chipedia.
Thank you.
Thank you, Marsha.